Hello, welcome back to the Irreverent Gentleman Podcast. I'm Trent Gander, and today we're going to be talking about information and tactics and how that can help us in our lives. Now, for the most part, people believe that the word tactics applies entirely to things like the military or police actions or other law enforcement activities. But in reality, tactics is just the good practices and the methodologies that we use to achieve something. In the most direct term, it can also mean something that's tactile or having to do with our hands. So it's our direct actions to things that result in outcomes that we would least want to try to achieve. What goes hand in hand with that is information and knowledge. These two things combined together can help us be very successful in our lives and not just bumbling around wondering, how am I going to get this done? What am I supposed to do? How am I going to resolve this problem? Well, today we're going to be looking into some of my favorite topics, actually, dealing with weapons and firearms and video games. Now, if you follow the blog, you'll know that I am a very avid gamer, and I really like more high-end simulator-type games that deal with more real-world, more realistic methods and hardcore modes. But because of my current financial situation, that I don't want to spend any money on it, I have to play less graphically intense games and less realistic games. So we're going to be looking at a couple of information-based problem solvers. And one of the old games I used to play, a game called War Thunder. So first off, we're going to start off. Well, why do we need to know about weapons? Well, weapons have shaped the world for millennia. In my blog post, Sharp Clubs and Parchment, I talk about how really the only thing that changes the world is ideas and violence, and how those things have shaped civilization to the point of where it's at currently. And the further we get from parchments and sharp clubs, we get farther and farther away from the ideals that really made the society that those were formed by obsolete. And that's not necessarily a good thing, because the farther we get away from the concepts and principles that guide ideas that create things and build things and ideas that cause people to try to defend those things, the more likely the system that those built will fall apart. So one of the things I like to do is watch TV shows or watch games and see, can I name that weapon? Is that weapon familiar to me? Why is this useful? And how does that tie into our life from a business perspective or just in general? Well, it gives us actually a lot, because it can tell us where somebody is from, what their infrastructure may be, and what access to weapons they have. And it can also can help us determine what are the capabilities of those weapons. How much of a danger are they? How much of a danger are they not? So, for example, we're going to look at games like Insurgency Sandstorm. The second member of the Insurgency series is a more hardcore shooter with a minimalistic background and kind of realistic heads-up display, meaning that you don't really have much of anything to gauge how much ammo you have, the minimap, the location of enemies. You have to do this all visually. That means you have to be able to learn to look for movement, look for humanoid shapes, maybe if they're even up there obscured, and to be able to identify who is friendly and who is not, depending on what side you're on or what they are equipped with. So we start off like at the top tier. One of the more easily recognizable weapons, you could say, is the AK series. Now, this gets a bit hard because there are a lot of AK variants ranging all over from the Eastern Soviet bloc to China to places in the Middle East and even American-made versions of AKs. The problem is they are chambered in two different rounds, and depending on the round, determines the capabilities, the overall shape, the equipment that goes onto it. So, for example, if I see someone have an Obzor non-battery-powered optic, I can tell that they are most likely either very well connected within the Russian circuit, or they have gone to great pains to obtain Russian equipment and put it on, particularly an AK-74. Yes, I said 74, not 47. The 74 fires a smaller, more human-oriented round compared to the 47 or AKM that deals more with a heavier round that can defeat barriers a little bit better. But the 74 was developed after the 47 because while we were testing early versions of 5.56 in Vietnam, at least the US were, Russia re-engineered or reverse-engineered the basic 5.56 round into their 5.45 round, and that became one of the more popular intermediate cartridges, especially in the Soviet bloc. Well, for the most part, they are generally using 7.62x39, which is the original AK round, and one of the earliest examples of an intermediate cartridge, at least within the 1900s. The benefits on soft tissue from 5.45 are slightly more improved than the general utilitarianness of 7.62x39. How does that impact you if you're facing these things, whether in a game or anything, especially if it's realistic? Is 7.62x39 is more likely going to be able to penetrate walls, especially normal building materials, some levels of wood and other things like that. So what you think is going to be able to stop bullets may not stop bullets. If you're thinking, oh, I'm safe here, and all of a sudden a bunch of these rounds just blast through the cinder block next to you and you get hit, well, that's because 7.62x39 has more mass and can defeat barriers just a little bit better than the lighter rounds. You can still actually do it with the lighter rounds. It just takes more of them and a lot more kind of hosing at the wall. However, the benefits of 5.45 is that your recoil impulse will be a lot better, and you'll be able to have longer streams of fire more accurately in a more condensed area. So instead of just spraying all over the wall, you can put it down to a much smaller target and put more rounds on your enemy and therefore down them faster than you would if you are just jitterbugging it all over the place. Similar to this, a slightly more iconic firearm, shall we say, there are like 10 different variations of it, but it is called the FAL, made by F.N. Herstal, and made famous by Rhodesian military usage in the middle of the 1900s. The FAL is generally chambered in a 30 caliber round, the standard NATO round of 7.62x51. There are some other stranger variants, especially by the British. They have it in their own British caliber, but the importance of the FAL is that we'll be able to determine if they're from a South American country or someplace in the Philippines where they still issue these kind of rifles. And we also have the capabilities of 7.62x51 to deal with, because like the AK, the larger AK round, 7.62x51 can penetrate soft cover a lot more easily, especially things like cars and walls. The downside of this is that it's more recoil, but the FAL, depending on the size and variant of it, is a very heavy firearm, especially when you compare it to things like the AK and the AR-15 or the M16 variants. Those generally are 10 pounds or under, unless you have a bunch of stuff put on it, and then it's more like 10 to 12 pounds loaded. FALs are kind of reminiscent of early 1900s firearms, where it's like, oh, that's 10 pounds empty. And because of the larger and generally heavier rounds, they are going to equal more weight for you to carry with less capacity, and going to add to the overall heaviness of the gun, especially if you start adding on things like handguards and optics. So it gets into this really complex, very confusing game of logistics that go into fighting that people really don't think about. Oh, I can just carry all this stuff. It's like, no. I can carry a small backpack with just like some clothes, a book or two, maybe a laptop and a few other things and some water. And that can be rather heavy. That can get up to about maybe 5 to 10 pounds or more. And that's not carrying anything dense. If I was carrying food rations, ammunition, and all the other stuff that I would need to be able to either cook in the field or have ability to have some sort of non-locally sourced food with me that is going to climb up and up and up, especially if I have to have something like shelter. By the way, I've never been in the military. I just have a really great fondness for figuring out how combat and things like that work. So just to throw that out there. The other thing is, we can also determine how likely are their weapons are to break. What is their resupply chain? What kind of weapons could they actually have that we could actually use, depending on what they have? So if we find something like EG3 or the variant of it that's Set Me Heavy or Set Me Light, which is chambered in either 76251 or 556, depending on if it's a heavy or light Set Me variation, we can see that, okay, this is like the Western version of the AK. It's mass-produced, it's equipped with whatever weapon or whatever ammunition, and it's just like tossed to the soldiers who are probably not going to clean it. And if you are left-handed, unfortunately, the charging handle for a G3 or the Set Me series is like the MP5. It's more right-hand dominant is what it is. So if we see that in a individual's possession, we see that they're more likely supported by former German states or from places that have contacts with Germany's Heckler & Koch company and deal with things like that. And those have certain parts kits and certain requirements and certain things that you have to really deal with to overcome some of the drawbacks that they have. That is like, okay, that's an entirely different infrastructural support tree than, say, something for the FAL. Despite the fact that they're made by similar companies from similar places, they have a different manual of arms, they have a different location for things like charging handles and safeties, they even have different sights, and they sometimes even have different sighting systems that you can add on to it. So each different kind of tree of firearms has its own support tree underneath it. Add-ons such as red dot sights, magnified optics, handguards, lights, IR lasers, visible lasers, all these things start to play a part into, okay, how useful is this? What is the specific role of this weapon? And in games like Insurgency Sandstorm, we see that come to the fore. You can take a very low-tier weapon and add a bunch of what people call force multipliers onto them and make it a very usable, very specific skill set weapon, such as a very short AK or a Krenkov is suddenly put on with a suppressor, change the caliber to maybe something like 9.39 instead of 5.56 or, sorry, instead of 5.45 or 7.62.39. And you have this very subsonic weapon as good for close in engagements. Now, if you have this big old long Dragunov, I think most people know what a Dragunov looks like, it's like a super long AK. That's not going to be the exact same thing, because that was designed with a different purpose in mind, meaning the designated marksman role. So pretty much an individual within a squad to be able to reach out farther than what the squad is expected to engage with while providing a minor sniper overwatch role without having the handicap to what people normally think of sniper rifles, which is bolt action. Because if you're going to be rushing a room with a bolt action, it had better be the First or Second World War where you have nothing else, because that is a very losing proposition today in the modern world. That being said, you can still be killed by it. So it's this huge miasma of things that, like, there's a bunch of outdated technology within the firearms world that's still being used today is starting to eke more towards being obsolete, but it's still dangerous to you as an individual or to somebody else because they originally designed to kill things. So it doesn't mean it's not still designed to kill things, it's just that there are better options to do that task for a wider variety of things with better add-ons and better support and more reliability than something from, say, 150 years ago. And people still hunt with cap and ball and black powder white rifles today, and muskets even, just because they enjoy that, and it also is easier for certain hunting laws. And there's the there's a much larger game at play in the world of firearms than most people realize. That being said, we can now segue over to our other topic of today, which is tactics and how those can really change up a situation. Our next topic being the topic of tactics, combining into the overall plan of how we do things, is best illustrated with the game War Thunder. I love War Thunder. It's one of the very few games I've actually had a physical sensation in my hands when I thought about playing it. Yeah, I play that game some days 6 hours a day whenever I could, and I would play it whenever I could. And then it ran out of steam on my computer, so I had to stop. And hopefully I will one day get back into it. But I'm going to start telling a few stories from there. I was in a group, and I left eventually, but some of the individuals said, oh, we really don't like War Thunder, especially their tank combat, because War Thunder uses moderately realistic tank diagrams and tries to make it playable without having the drawbacks of, oh, everything's breaking down and we don't have enough fuel and things like that. So gamifying the real-world equivalents of tanks and other things like that. This means there are certain considerations to have. Now, the tanks in the tank trees for War Thunder, because War Thunder has air gameplay, land gameplay, and they're working on sea gameplay. So we're going to focus in on tank gameplay, because that's one of the most fun aspects that I had outside of the dogfight that I really enjoyed and really got good at. So there are medium tanks, small tanks, tank destroyers, and anti-aircraft. Pretty much varying levels of armor, and some things like the tank destroyers are more designed for long-range combat. Think of them as a sniper class, meaning that they're supposed to hit you way out over there, like 1,000, 2,000 meters, slinging these large 15-pound pieces of lead and iron and copper coming at you with explosives in them or not. This one time, I was in a particular German tank destroyer. I forget which one it is. I know it is more of a 75mm cannon and very lightly armored. I had positioned myself in one of the more popular maps at the time, and between me and the general advance of the enemy units was this very wide lake. Now, there was cover on the side of the lake. There's a lot of trees and bushes and stuff that would be able to obscure me from people trying to look and see me. But I could see them with my optics that I had built onto the gun. And I could see their advance, which was moving toward the, I want to say it was the south side of the town in the game, because it's based on a real-world location. It's on the south side of the town coming into a cluster of buildings. And these buildings give cover to the tanks as they approach, and also from friendly units moving in and securing positions within those places, because there's about 5 to 6 major lines of sight into the town that can be covered by 3 to 4 positions on either side. And so as this becomes this game of angles of, can I see through this tree? Can I see through? Can I see around the tree? Can I shoot through the tree? Can I see through this very tiny, very tight angle between these buildings and put a round directly through there and hit something that's important on my enemy? At this time, I was just lobbing shells and first either directly taking out or incapacitating enemy tanks very easily and very quickly. So much so that the enemy decided to call in an artillery strike and send about 4 different tanks to come and try to stop me, despite the fact that I was the only anti-tank gun or friendly or enemy to them unit in that area. I was by myself. There was no one else with me, but they decided they'd need an artillery barrage and to send 3, maybe 5 tanks after me to make sure that I stopped shooting them. Obviously, I had slightly better tactics than maybe the other ones. They tried to jump from cover to cover or concealment to concealment with their tanks, and they eventually were able to drive me from the position and or kill me. in the game, which shows that I was viewed as a large enough of a problem to waste important assets to remove. Now, back to those associates of mine. They complain that the tank warfare in War Thunder is way too easy to be one-shot in the game. And you can be one-shot with a number of things, whether it hits your ammunition capacity, whether it hits something that causes a fire, maybe it hits something that you don't have fire extinguishers built into your tank yet. Maybe it happens so that it has an explosive shell and it just kills everyone inside of them, backblast and overpressure and things like that. So there's all these really real world problems that happen inside a tank, but you're just controlling the entire tank crew and acting like the tank is one entity. Or you can just somehow manage to just have a round just go through the front of your tank, miss everyone, and take out your engine. I've had that happen more than once, and it's completely puzzling that it didn't hit the driver, the tank commander, or anyone else. It just has hit and knocked out the engine. Those are generally with British units, if I remember correctly, because the British generally had large, heavy shells that were not explosive, but were still very effective. The thing that my associates were complaining about, because it was so easy to get one shot, they didn't like to play the game. This tells me that they absolutely had no tactics at all. Because using the area around you, if you look at tank combat in the real world, and especially in places like Afghanistan, you'll see that they are very similar to small squad tactics, in that you'll have one or two members of a squad covering each other, and they're slowly moving into and around corners, checking angles, and making sure that if somebody is going to pop out and try to shoot them, that they can hit them first, or someone can hit them first if one other part of the team does not see it. However, once those start getting added in, you get more into those military simulator games, and a lot of people just play games like this just for fun and don't really want to think about the things and just rush in and try to shoot everything really fast, like in Call of Duty and older shooter games like that. More arcade shooters is the term. So knowing how to do that can give you a significant advantage over those who are more arcade shooters. Because, okay, yeah, I know that this particular round can go through this particular medium and still carry through and be able to hit something on the other side. There's also a number of other factors such as, okay, I know I can arc this thing over to where they actually are or use directional blast to really make their lives terrible. Or I can counteract heavier armor by either going up really close and using a particular type of shell or using a different shell, or as one of my associates recommended, not going around with full ammunition tank racks so that if an area like that is hit with an explosive shell, it doesn't detonate everything, or is less likely to detonate anything by accidentally hitting one of those shells. And that is a problem with certain Russian tanks. I forget what they are. I believe they are 75s or 73s. I forget which. It's been a while. It's been literally 4 or 5 years since I've actually played War Thunder. And man, do I miss it. So knowledge really is power, especially when you apply it directly and accurately. So if you say have a Tiger tank, like I have had in the game, it's like, okay, that's a very long range, very powerful tank. It has a lot of armor, and if you are far enough away, and if you have the angles just right, you can have rounds just bounce off you and laugh. And then you can also just one-shot character or one-shot enemy tanks very easily. So it's shot, move, shot, move, shot, move. Unless you're trying to control a very particular area, then we get into things like, okay, how long does it take to reload a shell? How long does it take for them to be able to find my position after I fired? And it gets into this such nitty-gritty, very, for me, very interesting set of logistics that it really energizes me, but for most people, it's just like, oh, that's just too much. You're thinking too much about this. It's like, yeah, I do, because I like that. I know how to do that. So tactics is really just weaponized information. and we need to weaponize our information in order to combat the problems that we face today. The information and tactics for your job may be entirely different than for someone clearing your room or playing a war game with tanks. But it's still the basic concept of knowing how and what to do in given situations that ties in to us as we do our day-to-day work and even some obscure work that pops up every so often, like once a year. That one special project that comes along that you have to do or you're assigned to do, knowing how to do that all ensures that maybe that becomes more of a regular thing, or that you can do it so well that the payoff is much higher than just the normal work that you're doing. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's little rant. I did vomit up a bunch of military jargon, and especially with caliber names. I do apologize. If you've read the blog, please leave a like or subscribe and follow and share it around the Gentleman's University of Manliness.wordpress.com. If you have not encountered the blog, follow us on all the places where you can hear audio podcasts, share the podcast around, and really, hopefully you've taken something away from this that is beneficial to you, because that's the reason why I do this. I want people to be able to learn from things that I've either done so that they don't have to make my mistakes themselves, or that they just find it interesting and they take that bit of information from it and apply it to the rest of their lives, or just have something interesting to listen to. So I will catch you next time on the next episode of the Reverend Gentleman Podcast. Until then, think about it and make sure you apply yourself tactically rather than reactionary.